Hi, thanks for coming to the nano panel. Consistent with the nano panel, I've been asked to give a really small discussion here, so I'm allowed 5 minutes at first, which is too bad because I have this great PowerPoint talk, and it's got sex and drugs in it, and the rock and roll part is that I'm supposed to talk really close to the microphone, like a rock and roll star, they told me. So I'm going to try and do that. My area, I work on toxic chemicals and federal regulation of chemicals. And so what I'm going to be talking about in nanomaterials is some of the health risks. I'm an environmental health scientist. I have 10 years in the lab, and my background is toxicology, molecular biology, developmental biology, neuro, heavy metal expertise. So I'm sort of a toxic or chemical expert. And I do federal regulation of toxics. So I work in Washington on all the pesticide regulations and a good deal of industrial toxics as well. Nano falls into my interest because it's all the new chemicals. So we have about 7,000 new chemicals registered every year, and almost all of them are nano. Nanochemicals are really so prevalent because these rock stars probably have this problem too. They're more reactive than normal chemicals in a lot of different ways, and that's because they have more surface area per mass. So if you think of your periodic table, and nothing's changed, we haven't like blown out the periodic table or anything, but at the atom level, at the atomic level, because remember nothing can be smaller than atoms, you can't break down matter smaller than atoms still, so we haven't changed the laws of physics per se, but we can now use engineering techniques to design chemicals in certain ways. We can take those atoms and form them and organize them in ways that weren't possible before, and lay them out in patterns, and that's essentially what nanotechnology is. It's a technology, it's not a new chemical, but it's a way of making new chemicals, but also other things too. It's engineering, and it's chemistry, and it's biology together. So they're coming in the future, and I think some of you guys will talk about it. There's going to be a lot of like biological chemical interfaces happening. So nanotechnology is going to be in everybody's field. A lot of people compare it to like GMOs, genetically modified organisms, but that's actually just in agriculture. There is nano in agriculture. There's new nanopesticides, and EPA just registered the first one, nanosilver, actually, for use on textiles like clothing and teddy bears and pillowcases and knives and forks and spoons and cutting boards in your kitchen. I'm recommending against buying these things because the health testing is very poor at this point, but it's not just in pesticides, it's in every sector. It's going to be our new flexible solar panels. It's going to be all of our digital and electronic equipment. It's already in shampoos and cosmetics and hairsprays. It makes shampoos flow nicely. If you think of ball bearings, how ball bearings make things flow, these are like the ultimate ball bearing. They're very, very small. So some nanoparticles are being used like that. They're being used in some foods, a lot of food packaging. So anything you work on, if you write on lipstick or you write on cosmetics or personal care products or pillowcases or solar or energy or ag, nano is in your field. So what I want to tell you a little bit about, I promised there'd be sex in here. So also, there's some nano douches. I honestly wish I had a PowerPoint here, and it's really awesome, but we're not allowed to show PowerPoints, but don't buy those either. That's my advice. There's also nano running bras. There's nano clothing. They have nano silver in them so that they smell less. The silver actually kills bacteria. It does work. It does kill bacteria. And they also have nano titanium dioxide to keep the sun off you. So the advertisement here says, your boobs have a mind of their own, but we know what they're thinking. And what they're thinking is that they want bras that keep the sun off and don't smell bad. So I think that's cool because like I actually don't know what my boobs think, but it's nice that they do. Carbon nanotubes are small carbon molecules. So carbon can range from like what's in your pencil to like the diamonds are all carbon. So the way you organize those molecules matters. And engineers can lay them out in sheets and roll them up like a tube, and they become very firm, very strong tubes. They're stronger than steel, 100 times stronger than steel, and 6 times lighter. They're being used in a lot of military wear right now, which is a really good use of them, I think. They're also being used in car parts They can make cars stronger and lighter, so you get better fuel mileage. I think that's a good use. But if you breathe them in, they can also act like asbestos fibers. They're very rigid. They aren't able to be phagocytosed or destroyed by immune cells. So they can actually cause asbestos-like disease in rodents much faster and at much lower doses than asbestos, far more potent than asbestos. So I don't think it would be a good idea to breathe these in. EPA is in the process right now of approving them for use. They are already being used, so EPA is a little behind on that. But they're asking for a 90-day inhalation study. That's all they're asking for. So EPA is not asking for any two-generational studies, no reproductive studies, no studies to see whether it goes into the past the blood-brain barrier, the feel or placental barrier, skin or dermal penetration. They're not asking for any of that. They're not asking for any long-term or chronic studies, just a 90-day inhalation study. So I'm working with the unions right now. We've put comments in to EPA, and we're working with them and OSHA right now to try and do better. They're also recommending that workers wear respirators. I think that's probably a good idea. They're regulated under FIFRA, for pesticides. They're regulated under TSCA, the Toxic Substances Control Act, for industrial chemicals. But like I say, EPA is approving them, but only asking for 90-day inhalation studies. They're also in a lot of consumer products, which I mentioned. But the Consumer Product Safety Commission actually does not have the authority to regulate materials. They only have recall authority after the fact. So if there's harm shown in the public, Consumer Product Safety Commission can recall a product. That is it. That is all they can do. They don't approve, and they don't ask for data beforehand.
Yeah, and we'll talk about regulation a bit more after each of
And you. FDA also has only post-market recall. So all the cosmetics fall under FDA. Medicine is a little better. There's a lot of good nanomaterials in medicine. That's pretty exciting, so I'll talk about that after if you guys want. The budget. Money matters. So the federal budget for nanomaterials involves about $380 million going to DOE. They're doing a lot of cleanup technologies and other things we don't know about, but it would be cool if someone started asking them questions. DOD, Department of Defense, has about $415 million. Again, we don't know a whole lot. They're doing some on defense, like carbon nanotubes and clothing and Kevlar. I think those are good, but a lot of what they're doing we don't know about. EPA, that would be the agency charged with protecting the environment, $17 million. So this isn't even the tail of the tiger. This is so small. NIOSH, you might have heard of them, small little agency involved in worker health, $9 million. So the environmental health and safety and occupational health and safety money is not keeping up with how fast this technology is moving. And that is
yeah, we'll also talk about the budget a little bit more. Okay, thank you. Aaron?
Yeah, thanks again for coming, and thanks to Melissa for inviting me. So I'm with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. We're the living memorial to President Wilson, funded by Congress in 1968, largely focused on foreign policy. My program is the Science and Technology Innovation Program, where I'm a writer-editor. We're a little bit different because we're focused on governance and regulatory issues for emerging technologies, including nano. We also look at synthetic biology, geoengineering, serious games, and crowdsourcing used in disaster response are kind of our big things right now. April 2005, we started with the Pew Charitable Trust, worked on something called the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies, and that's sort of where we get into the nano space. The goal of the project is to ensure that risks are minimized, benefits are maximized, and the public is engaged on this every step of the way. So. Before that, before January of this year, I was actually an environmental reporter. I covered toxics, pesticides, Clean Water Act, nano for Inside EPA, which is a policy newsletter in Washington. One of the things that I mentioned that Wilson does is public engagement, and a lot of that is both surveys. Every year we do a national survey on emerging technologies with Heart Research. And we also do a lot of focus groups, and so I thought it might be interesting to kind of break out a few of the big findings for you guys, because there's things you might want to keep in mind as you're working on your stories, just as sort of framing devices. I think the big one that keeps coming up is that these aren't on the radar of the general public, really, these technologies. In a 2010 poll we did, two-thirds of the respondents said they had little or no knowledge of nanotechnology. Awareness is growing. In that same survey, 34% said that they had a lot or some awareness of nanotechnology, and that was the highest that we had ever gauged. So that's something to keep in mind, that, you know, when I used to do stories on nano, even though I was writing for sort of an educated policy audience, I still had to put in the boilerplate of what nano was in case this wasn't something that was on people were thinking about. Another thing we're finding in the focus groups is that people who are aware of nanotechnology often think about these things in sort of cultural narratives, existing cultural narratives, things like, you know, a Trojan horse scenario where you have where you let something, where you accept a technological innovation and then later it becomes something, you know, has an unintended consequence, something like DDT, where it was used for a long time, and then we started to see problems with it. So people learn these things through news, through nonfiction, through movies and books and things like that. The oops scenario, accidental release due to technological or human failure. You know, these are the ways that people are thinking about things. When we ask them about nanotechnology and what they're worried about, if they've heard of it, this is what comes up quite often. Another key thing to think about is that when it comes to the use of nanotechnology, applications really matter. There's a strong relationship between the social utility of an application and the amount of risk that people are willing to take on. Utility is a key to whether an application is accepted. Let me give you an example of this from 2009. We asked people how they felt about using nanotechnology in food storage containers. 13% of the respondents said that they would not use a food storage container that was enhanced with nanotechnology, the Tupperware that had nano in it. We then asked about whether or not they would buy food that contained nanotechnology. And 29% said that they would not purchase food that had been enhanced with nanotechnology. So the closer you get to people's mouths, the closer you get to their bodies, that people start to really question whether or not they're interested in this. We see this with other technologies as well. We did a survey on synthetic biology, and we asked, if this were to be used in a flu vaccine, would you see this as a positive or a negative? 60% said that would be positive. We said, what about synthetic biology and a growth hormone for livestock, for animals? And it was basically the inverse. 60% said that would be a bad idea. You know, there's no food shortage, but protecting yourself from bird flu or something, maybe that's something people are interested in. A couple other just sort of quick hits. The public has more trust in the federal agencies to manage emerging technologies, FDA, EPA, USDA, DOE, and that's much higher than industry and self-regulation, where there's a lot less trust. And in our focus groups, the public tended to converge around three recommendations for improving public acceptance or confidence in nanotechnology, and these are pretty interesting. Number one is greater transparency and disclosure. Number two is pre-market testing. And number three was third-party testing and research. One other thing that we do is the consumer products inventory, which is basically a list of products that are on the market that contain nano. Work was started in 2005. It went online in 2006. It was most recently updated in March of 2011. We're hopefully going to do a pretty big revamp early next year. I was hoping to come here today and tell you guys about it, but we're not there yet. And it's going to hopefully address some of the shortcomings that exist in the inventory as it is. And so hopefully that'll be good, and we can talk more about that later. It currently has over 1,300 products. If you look at it, you'll see the health and fitness section is huge. And when I started at Wilson, I asked someone about that. And that's because that's where your sunscreens, personal care products, and cosmetics all fit in there. And that seems to be where a lot of the action is right now. If you want to look at that, excuse me. If you want to look at that, www.nanotechproject.org, and it's pretty easy to find the inventory there, and it breaks it down. There's one that's focused on medicine and medical devices, and thank you.
Thank you, Aaron. Rom.
Well, good morning. And as a host institution, I do want to welcome you all. Maybe a last day to welcome, but that's. It's welcome is welcome, and hope you would have enjoyed the big land, big sky, and warm people. Anyway, having said that, I've been given 5 minutes. You know, professors are very much addicted to PowerPoint and mic, but so I'm kind of handicapped without both of those. And I'm asked to talk about technology and lay things. And I wanted to do something different. I wanted you all to see what nanotechnology is. Most of you are journalists. If some of you would have gone to some labs, you would have seen. But we have some nanotechnology product here, and I'll show you, and that's environmentally sustainable. You can touch it. It will not kill you. So I do take nanotechnology. I'm a professor. I direct the nonwovens and advanced materials lab. Some of you already visited my tour the other day. But this afternoon, we are also going to host a Sustainable Act tour. If you are interested, you can sign in. And if you want reviews, there are two people here who attended, so you can ask them. Okay, so I'm a technologist. Basically, I'm a material scientist. And we do develop products out of nanotechnology. So that's the premise. I may have a bias, but I'm trying to be unbiased here. And I look at nanotechnology into two things from the prism, two prisms. One, this Jennifer and Aaron made my life easy. Jennifer told that nanotechnology is good. She told Lord, bad, that's good. But one thing she good is in medicine. And I want to add on to that, medicine and defense sectors are relatively better jump now to investigate and take nanotechnology at a practical level. And then Aaron said it's an application you have to look into. So I'm going to argue my statement based on that. And this is all based on the old aphorism. It is you stand where you sit. So you take nanotechnology depending on where you want to take it. And two, as a toxicologist, my student gave me this tip, it's the dose matters. Right? So you know this. So it's where you want to take nanotechnology, where you are looking at it. If it's desperately necessary to save the life, it is better to save a man's life now. So you need to look into that from that point of view. And second, is that application worth enough my time and the money? So that's what I'm going to argue. Why nanotechnology? So a simple example is if you need to know a little bit on nanotechnology, nanotechnology is as old as a human being has been in existence. Human being is made up of DNA, which is 2.5 nanometers. And what comparing and contrasting that with the thing which we all care for, the theme of this conference, it's whiskey for drinking, water for fighting. So if you take water, water is roughly 2.5 millimeters in diameter or width. So there is 1 million order difference between a water and a nano material we are talking. So that's the thing. If you want to know what nano is not a chemical, Jennifer told. Nano is a science. Nano is basically manipulating the atoms in such a way that you are trying to add value to the existing product. That's all it is. You manipulate using biology, you manipulate using simple electron microscope. As long as you are able to create a product which will differ in its behavior from its bulk level. That is nano. In a journalistic term, nano is just not a chemical, not a product. It is just a science of manipulation at one atom level. So the structure of DNA came to the public domain in 1953. Then why didn't people look into nano? When did all the word nano started? It's exactly some 51, 52 years back in 1959. That's when nano became kind of a science, kind of a discipline. When a Caltech physicist, Richard Feynman, talked about nano, he didn't even know term the word nano. Then he said there's so much things you can do at the bottom. That means you are trying to build new products, new machine, even new human being from the genetic background. That's building from bottom up is nanoscience. So how would you do regulations? How would you investigate the effects of nano? You need to first produce nanomaterials. And then you need to know how they look like. So that's the thing. What was the thing people will ask? Okay, nano has been there. Did we use products before testing? Just to 10, 20 years we have been testing the products since 2000. It was only in 2000 when United States government formed the National Nano Initiative. That time only 8 federal agencies were there. Now at least 26 federal agencies are on board, with a budget of about $1.8 billion. The Sari state is still there. Since 2005, the cumulative budget for environmental aspect is only $650 million out of $18 billion spent over 12 years. That's the issue. But first, we need to develop products. We need to understand the science, and we need to have the tools. The tools came into being only in 1981 with IBM invention on a scanning tunneling microscopy. So concept was there. People understood the physics. Jennifer talked about the physics. The physics is simple because you can put, I give a simple analogy to my students. Just take a coffee stirrer and a Coke straw. Both are cylindrical material. But in a Coke straw, you can squeeze so many coffee stirrers. That means you are putting small particles into a big one, relatively bigger cylindrical material, so that you get more surface area. When you expose more surface area, you get more reactivity. That's all it is. So what you do, we are trying to improve the reactivity or improve the surface area of a material from its bulk level so that you are trying to capture more benefit out of it. Obviously, the question comes, okay, if you are making the particles tiny, smaller and smaller and smaller, obviously the properties will change. So two things have to be investigated. Is there going to be a problem? For example, we all know what gold is. Gold is gold. Gold is yellow in color. But when you break down gold into a tiny atom at one atom level, there are reports gold doesn't even absorb light. Some say it's green in color. Then if you go above the orders, it is pink in color. So it changes its characteristics. That's the one thing. So we need to exploit those changes for the benefit of humankind. That can be done by investigating the ill effects of it. That is still in infancy. So that's what we need to do. There are reports, different reports. Of course, United States is taking a lead. At least Jennifer talked about Dusner recently, October 5th, they came up with anything less than 100 nanometers, it needs certain considerations in the manufacture. That's particularly, these are all for case by case, so the SNR dictates on potassium titanium dioxide at the nano level, less than 100 nanometers. Whereas during the same time, on October 3rd, European Commission came up with a report. Quite contrasting to that, this was a commission report to the European Parliament stating that titanium is less toxic, relatively. So EPA comes that this has been found on inhalation route that 100 nanometer and less is toxic. Whereas European Commission's report, that's a second review report from European Commission to the Parliament. And it says, and it cites the less toxicity of titanium as an example, and they say the toxic effects are not substantiated. So that's where we are. But as long as the dose is under control, as long as the application is of paramount importance and benefits overweigh the risks, we should do this. And that's, I'm very pleased that in the latest budget of $1.8 billion for FY13, there is one program for $84 million. It doesn't say, okay, go manufacture solar cells. They put a huge money, relatively $84 million for sustainable nano manufacturing. At least things are coming. So we need to look at nano from application point of view. As long as it is not going to go and bind with DNA. Jennifer talked about those biological things. As long as it doesn't get binded with your DNA, as long as it doesn't have that kind of a lethal effect, if it's going to provide some benefits, we should not throw it away. We should look at it. To do that, it should be done only based on science. For that, I agree totally with Jennifer that agencies like EPA has to be given more funding to help people like us, to help people like Jennifer, to inform based on good science. So that's all. European Union, United States is not focusing much money on science for nanotoxicity. That will come. Because I feel from a researcher point of view that this field is only 12 years since the creation of NNI. With that, I will leave it. And I have the reports with me. If any journalist is interested, I can refer you to those reports. It's conflicting. So I was telling Melissa that she had given most tough job because the same week, you get one report from EPA saying that it has inhalation route, it is toxic, whereas European Commission cites the same compound, titanium, is not that toxic, so they are going to reopen this can of worms again. So that's where we stand. So, but I again leave, if the dose should dose, as a toxicologist, I have a senior mentor here, Professor Ron Kendall, who is a world-renowned toxicologist, so he may better talk on that than I. Dose is always the poison. Even yesterday he was telling Ram, even if you drink too much water, that's a poison. So from science point of view, it's the dose. And if the application warrants, for example, in medicine, I'll finish with one example. So in medicine, people want to target only those cancerous cells and then not touch the good cells. That can be done only if you have those tiny, minuscule particles that carry an antibody to that antigen cancer. So we need to look at it. And at the same time, as long as you have a material which is proven to be biocompatible, you can do it. Because nanoparticles are not nanoparticles what you think. Nanoparticles are the building blocks of something which you use, and that's what it is. This is a nanoparticle. Nobody will believe it's a nanoparticle, but it's a nanoparticle. This is made up of a number of, maybe a millions of nanofiber produced from polyvinyl alcohol. Polyvinyl alcohol is a water soluble. biocompatible material. So we take that polyvinyl alcohol and make it into an individual minuscule fiber or a material of 300 to 400 microns. And then because of the surface area, they bond together and you get patches like that. I'll just open it.
I'm going to stop you here because yes, I think you're
so
getting
this is what it is. This
too
is
deep into the science, but definitely go on his lab tour if you want to get into the deep part of the science. I want to go back to each of you, without prompting, each of you touched on this. One of the questions or one of the subjects I want to go back to and have each of you address a little more thoroughly is the different types of uses. And Aaron, you mentioned the public is comfortable with some and not with others. And Jennifer, you mentioned, as Ram said, medicine is probably a good one. If each of you would talk a little bit more about sort of what are maybe acceptable or less risky or more benefit type uses. I mean, you've got the difference from saving lives in medicine to sunscreen or making your boobs happy. Talk just a little bit about the different uses and which ones, in your professional expert opinion, you see as good places to go and maybe not such good places to go.
Sure. So I want to hit that point and another important one about toxicology. So first of all, I think that medicine is regulated differently. So I did promise drugs as well in my conversation. I think the medical and drug applications are good applications, but those really good applications, but those are also regulated. They go through a different regulatory structure within FDA. So it's a different conversation, and it's not fair to have a conversation about the advantages of nanomaterials by talking about life-saving drugs, which they are doing there, and I can talk about those, but actually Ram can probably do a much better job than me, and then make an extrapolation to therefore the risks or the benefits override the risks, or that they're being regulated somehow, they're not, by these other authorities, or that they're safe or worth it. I think that's a different conversation between your cancer-saving drug and your lipstick, and people have that conversation differently, and they're regulated differently. So that's the first thing. And I'm going to let Ram actually talk about the medical applications, but I do have a PowerPoint here, and I do have them all listed. And actually, Aaron's at Woodrow Wilson Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies, they do have the best and the only database available in the world. Ugh, rock star problem. But what I do want to say for environmental journalists is that nanomaterials are going to be in all the solutions. So your solar panels that are going to be flexible and are going to be light and are going to be portable and are going to be more effective are going to be nanomaterials. So they're developing, for example, solar flexible solar panels right now that are shaped like leaves. So you could put it on the side of your house and they would like move in the wind and the sun and they would look green or autumn color. They're developing both. And they would be solar panels. You can get small flexible solar panels that are being developed that you could put on the side of your purse or pocket and charge things inside while you're walking around. These are really good for military uses where you can't plug in and you're out in the hot sun marching all day long, and you could be actually charging up really critical devices in the military. So, and nobody's going to eat their solar panel. So those are some smart things. But when you're looking at all the environmental solutions and all the green stuff, it's all going to be nanotechnology. Water filtration is going to be nanotechnology, and it is now. And DOE is doing field trials that are quite effective, doing nano zero valent iron into aquifers to treat TCE, trichloroethylene, and arsenic, both serious, serious toxic chemicals and widespread pollutants in this country. So that would be great to be able to make them go away. But I don't know what the definition of go away is, because now they're just adding zero valent iron to that, and they're not looking at what's happening after that. So now you've added zero valent iron to an aquifer. So, I mean, those are smart research areas. And so whatever you're working on, the environmental solutions will be nano, is the easy answer. And I want to talk about the dose mix of poison. So I want to expand that, and I'm not saying anything that Ram doesn't know or Ron Kendall at the back of the room, who's an expert toxicologist, doesn't know. But, I mean, quoting a guy that, you know, from 500 years ago or whatever to say that's where toxicology ended is inaccurate. So the dose does make the poison, that's true. You can't be poisoned by something you're not exposed to. That's true. You have to be exposed to it. But in addition, the timing makes the poison. So, for example, lead, the amount of lead that is harmful to an infant or a child or a fetus is very, very different than the amount of lead that is hazardous to an adult. Occupational levels of exposure that are allowable are far higher than what we allow infants and children, right? Same with mercury. Things will scramble your brain in a fetus, so it won't do it to an adult. So it's very unfair to keep saying the dose makes the poison.
Let's come back to that. Let's answer this question real quickly.
That applies to this whole conference.
Yeah, I hear you. Aaron, you want to answer that?
Oh, just briefly, yeah, I'd reiterate one of Jennifer's points that you know, the FDA process for drugs is obviously quite a bit different than for industrial chemicals or for pesticides over EPA, and that's something that you have to consider. I think we've been finding one thing that we'd like to add to the product's inventory eventually would be looking at exposure routes, because obviously that's a huge, I think, part of the equation. And then the other point would be that we're finding that products are increasing. But I think oftentimes when reporters write about this, when I used to write about it, when probably more kind of mainstream than just a policy reporter would write about it, we often focus on kind of the potential here. And I think so far in terms of products, we're seeing things more kind of on the novelty end of the spectrum. I mean, lipsticks and sunscreens and things like that are interesting, but it's I don't know if we're at the point, you know, we're still working on some of the medicines and some of the materials that'll go into an airplane or something and make it more efficient or whatever. So I think it's still sort of that still happening. And I think there's that chart, I can't remember which one it is, where the public gets sort of burned out on there's all this promise and then it takes three times as long. I mean, the work's going on every day, but they don't see the results right away. And then everyone moves on to the next thing. But so those are my thoughts.
Okay, I do agree that dose and exposure makes sense. I just used the aphorism dose. Anyway, so we all agree on that. The two things which they left something for me to talk about, which is near and dear to me, is two industrial sectors where we don't have to that much worry about FDA regulations and things getting into your body. One is defense sector. It's actually in use. Many of the journalists may not know. They are using nanoparticles not to in the inhalate or the digestion route or consumption. They are basically used as a topical product, more or less similar to the cosmetics, but they find immediate use because nanoparticles, particularly nanomagnesium oxides, nanometal oxides, have been found to have high catalytic activity against toxins, nerve agents. So that's one use people are already using. There are commercially people are producing, tested. They have passed the readiness level. So defense sector, that's the thing we should not forget. And people talked about using iPhones, even on a flexible iPhones, but defense people depend because where nano will help is as long as you reduce the bulk a soldier has to carry, because he has to be agile. So logistically, he's already having heavy weight. On top of it, he's putting 20-30 pounds of a ballistic suit. If you can, by nanotechnology, reduce the weight a soldier can carry, that's the message. That will sell on itself. It improves the performance. It saves energy because you don't have to power a huge, heavy, gigantic materials on a soldier. And at the same time, what nano is all about? Nano is all about increasing reactivity, increasing surface area. So you're able to add value, protect life. So defense industry is already a leader, so that we should not forget. And the second one is, of course, a mechanical industry, basically an automobile industry. And people are working in batteries. Lithium batteries have been found to be very effective if you use nanotubes and nanoparticles because they provide more oxygen. So those have real applications. Well, medicine is a long route with all regulations, but there are some applications we should not miss where there is some promise. So industry, mechanical industry, defense industry, automobile industry, apart from the sexy cosmetic industry we talk about, there are other industries where we can put good use of nanotechnology.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to ask one more quick question of the panel, and then I'm going to let you guys start, have Adam. I'd just like for you to real briefly address the whole labeling issue, and obviously it's complex. I mean, the more we talk, the more complex this whole issue gets because it is such an incredibly broad array of uses. But I guess perhaps more for the consumer side of things, just your feeling on where we should be going maybe with labeling and what's realistic, and I'll let you guys take it.
Yeah, so the reason why labeling is an issue is because basically the way the federal agencies for the most part are dealing with nano, even though they have made statements to the opposite, the regulatory forum, they're being treated as the conventional scale chemicals. Whereas at the nanoscale, they're more bioavailable for the most part. In other words, easier to inhale, get deeper into the lungs, pass through cell membranes, pass from once into the bloodstream. They can go anywhere. EPA showed with nanosilver, which it just approved and registered, that it gets through the blood-brain barrier, through the fetal or placental barrier, and into all organs once it was in the bloodstream of rodents when it was tested. And we know that from other materials as well. And we know that it kills cells because it's an antimicrobial. And EPA knows that. They have that data. So that's something to keep in mind with nanomaterials generally. It doesn't mean every nanomaterial acts the same, and you can add a surface coating and do all sorts of things to alter them. They come in different shapes and different properties, but generally, just from small size, they're much more bioavailable and much more transferable in the body. Secondly, they're more chemically reactive because their surface area is so great compared to their mass, which is almost nothing. So they have much more opportunity to bump into things and have chemical reactions, and that changes their toxicity profile. So again, everyone is different. You can't make a general statement, but you can generally presume and ask the questions, is it more toxic? It probably is, because it's probably more reactive, and that's why it's being chosen by the manufacturer for that application. So the issue of labeling is the materials aren't labeled and consumers can't make choices themselves, so you can't make an educated choice. But you can generally assume that if something says, you know, it's got silver in it, it's nanosilver. Or same with titanium or aluminum dioxide in your sunscreens and skin screens. There's buckyballs, which are in cosmetics, and there are these really tiny little carbon atoms are arranged, 60 carbon atoms are arranged like a soccer ball unit, and they fill the lines and cracks in your face, so it's an anti-aging cream. So you're putting this stuff right in the cracks and lines in your face, and it works. It does work. It's a high-end anti-aging cream, but buckyballs have been shown also to kill brain cells, and they do pass through the blood-brain barrier, and they do. So does it get from your skin into your brain? I don't know. In animal studies, they injected it. But these are the kinds of things you'd want to know before it ends up in your cosmetics, and we don't know. They're not being tested. They're not being approved at the nanoscale. The nano aren't going through a separate approval process, and we don't have the data on that. Only government-funded scientists are putting out that data right now. And the products aren't labeled, so consumers can't make the choice, although you can go to Aaron's website and take a look.
And we're going to look good, so. Aaron?
Does it matter?
Well, we don't. Yeah.
I use it, I'm 90.
Yeah.
The inventory was originally, you know, initially based on labels, and that makes it hard because sometimes they'll label something as nano and it won't have it in there. I think that's changing. I think with the concerns about nano, they're probably, you know, sometimes they'll. You know, if they take the words nano off a pesticide product, then they're exempt from any kind of... If they'll make a nano claim on the box...
A pesticidal claim.
A pesticidal claim. They don't have to go through the FIFRA process. So would you rather go through the FIFRA process, or would you rather print new boxes? And then you can sort of see there's sort of some inverse incentives there. I think there's some work done in the United Kingdom about labeling. I think the public wants it, but then in the same study or focus group or whatever it was, they're also kind of saying that there's no guarantee that anyone would necessarily read it. So you have kind of, yes, we want this to be labeled, but then will that change consumer behavior? That's a good question. When it comes to food, no one wants to talk about it. There's someone at an NGO who went around to some of the big food makers and was trying to determine what are you doing in terms of nanotechnology, and as you can imagine, from industry, got no response. We're not talking to you about any of this. And I think, you know, you take a step back. And then in industry and in other emerging technologies, I think we're starting to see that industry is very, you know, using a word like synthetic biology. They kind of looked at GMOs, they looked at nano, and they're sort of saying, are we ready to tout this yet? Is this going to be something that's accepted, or should we sort of be holding off? And you do have this kind of bigger framework of, you know, when they're going to the regulator, they're saying, no, this is no different than the bulk chemical. This is no different than regular corn, you know, seeds or whatever. But then when you're advertising it, you're saying this is new and improved, this is different. So you kind of have that tension there.
Okay, I'm not a consumer guru here, but my take is it's from the point of view of industry, it's beneficial to have a labeling from their PR point of view, but it's not regulated, so they are not doing. But I have seen some cosmetic products which do say nano silver in it, but now that it's kind of a regulated. But Australians have done it. Jennifer knows recently I knew that it's required there to label, I guess. So zinc oxide, they are labeling it. So it's basically a stewardship from the industry point of view, if it helps. I think it will help, so that should be there. Second thing is the question of nano silver comes, and Jennifer talked, and I also did a lot of work and got some grants as well on looking at the surface area. But very recently, this is some news I wanted to give you. Very recently, there has been one report to our knowledge. We have four students sitting. They all done some good research for me to talk here. They all work in nano. So we have found from a very reputed university a research that came out saying that it's not the, from biocidal point of view, we use silver to kill a bacteria. They say it's not the size of the particle that kills, it's basically the silver itself in ionic form. So going back to square one. So it's this nano has opened up a lot of debate. It's not the nano silver, it's not the nano, it's the ionic silver. That's we all know. Silver in an ionic form is a biocidal. So when we are trying to work on it, so hopefully additional data will tell whether really it's nano that matters for these kind of applications. That's the thing I wanted to talk is, people are now going and reinvestigating. Is it still the size matters? People are working on it. So we only found one published report on it. So that gave us some impetus for us to go and work on it. So that's what it is.
Okay. We're going to start with questions from the audience. This is obviously a controversial subject. Everyone has an opinion. This is not the place to make your statements and editorial opinions. If you want to get with any of the speakers afterward or sit, grab them at lunch, that'd be great. But this is for asking questions, briefly if possible. Please stand and identify yourself and ask your question. And one of us, will probably me, will repeat the question since we're taping this. So, yes, do you have a question? Okay, see if I can summarize that. So your question is, how do we go from looking at it from the big bulk, whatever the nanotechnology is, the benefits, to what might happen at a smaller level, little particles, wherever they end up?
Yeah, so Ram's right. It's the ions that come off the nanosilver, and I'm going to use nanosilver because it's in more consumer products than any other nanomaterial that we know about. It's in about 100 consumer products the product's claim is in it, that we know about it. And it is the ions that come off, but more ions come off the nanosilver than off the conventional silver. So that's what makes nanosilver more toxic than conventional silver. And those are not only highly toxic in your cells, which EPA has the data, it's in the EPA's docket because they just registered it, so they have all the data in their docket. And my organization litigated, we're trying to block that approval. It's very highly attracted to aquatic organisms. That's the deal with nanosilver and silver. So silver is already registered. It's more toxic than mercury in aquatic organisms. And EPA knows that it's regulated under as a criteria pollutant. And nanosilver is more toxic than silver. And EPA's argument for registering that was that it was in the public's benefit because you could use less of it, because it was more toxic, so you could use less of it. And our argument was, yeah, but it's this new uses. You're expanding the use base because you're approving it for freaking pillowcases and teddy bears, you know? So, whatever. So we have a litigation on that. Carbon nanotubes, everybody recognizes. I mean, DuPont did the first study, and they published it. They were public on that. So there's been half a dozen studies on carbon nanotubes. NIOSH has published it. So, I mean, carbon nanotubes just look and feel and taste like asbestos fibers, and that's all there is to it. But different sizes actually have different toxicities. So knowing that in advance, that companies can at the R&D stage, if they do their toxicity studies at the R&D stage, if they're aware of environmental health at that R&D stage, then they can actually start to design out some of those risks. Ram pointed it out, some of the nanomaterials are actually of the size that can actually bind, for example, to the spaces in a DNA. So if you have a molecule that's actually interfering with DNA, that's what carcinogens look like. And so knowing that, without even doing a two-year cancer assay, just knowing it, don't design it so that it can intercalate with DNA. That's just not a smart design if it doesn't have to do that for its purpose. Most of the risks are being taken by workers because they're getting the product in powder form or in raw form to fabricate. And then end of life, where it comes out of the product, So burning, disposal, crushing. If you grind your own brakes, you're going to get a lot more asbestos than the guy that doesn't. It's that kind of thinking, right? So if you have a high-end bike that's got a lot of carbon nanotubes, so it's super light and super fast, and that makes you, like, awesomely cool on the road, but you're also the kind of person that's going to grind it down to add stuff to it or, you know, do stuff, then you're probably getting it from the paint and from the metal. So those are the kinds of things we need to think about, even in the products where nobody's going to eat their bike per se or eat their car brakes per se, but it's still in there. So those are the kinds of things that we have to think about. And one really important point is that not all scientists are the same. Like, I don't go to a real estate lawyer to get a divorce. Like, so, I mean, every scientist isn't the same, and they're not all toxicologists. So, you know, chemists and fabricators and material scientists are not trained in toxicology necessarily. They should, and some are, and some do have that conversation. That's a scientific issue that we need to have that. We need to train more scientists to think about human health. But they're not right now. So, you know, as journalists, don't just think because you're talking to someone with a PhD that they know what they're talking about. Scientists often don't know what they don't know. They think they know, but they're not trained in that area, and it's not fair to be answering those questions for you.
Do either of you want to respond?
Okay. The one thing is, I'm glad that Jennifer said, I know that I don't know a lot of things. So, yeah. So that's why. So, but one thing I really appreciate, Janet, this is what, if one thing that came out of this is the question you asked, that's spot on. It's the education. I'm a scientist. I write proposals to NSF. The sole thing is to generate product, understand basic science. The one thing is, are there enough data? This is something important. I'm glad you asked this question. Thank you, Ms. Janet. Are there enough information and are those conveyed to the public? Is nanotoxic at that level? Because people can argue, okay, I take, this is a tissue scaffold made of nano, but it will not be toxic at that level. The chemistry may not be toxic, but it is that at that level, nano level. Is nanotoxic at nano level? That's the information that has to get out. That's kind of in the shuffle that gets lost. That's the thing we need to convey. At that nano level, it's proven, very well proven, that silver and copper break through BBB, blood barrier barrier, and it's toxic in daphnia. But how are we conveying it? It's that size of a particle when it gets transported after disintegration. That's what I was coming at. Nobody tells that story. You asked because you've gone to and you report in Science News. That's the message that has to get out. Because people can argue. So I agree with Jennifer, but if you look at from a L'Oreal point of view, they can argue. It's only dermal exposure. It only affects the hair follicle. There are signs to prove it. But what if it attached to hair follicle, it's not toxic? Fine, the study leaves there. But when it disintegrates from the follicle and gets transported, what happens to that fate of that nanoparticle? That is what missing.
Aaron, did you want to...
No, I don't have anything to add. Fate and transport is obviously, I think, a huge issue, but yeah. I got a C in chemistry in college.
Jennifer, so
that is important, too, yeah. You can put things on your skin that you shouldn't inhale and stuff, so definitely. I want to mention one more thing about the scientists. So I work on a lot of chemicals, but when I work on nano, I started being invited to talk at universities all over the country. I also sat on the President's Advisory Council on Science and Technology. They had a work group on nanotechnology that I was on. It was all like, we weren't supposed to talk about it. I'm not supposed to talk about it to the press. But I will tell you that when I speak in front of academic audiences, 3/4 of the people in those audiences hold patents on nanomaterials. So you have to ask them when you call scientists if they're holding patents when they're developing stuff. That's an issue that you should know. Everybody around the President's Advisory Council on Science and Technology, the work group on nanomaterials, had patents and financial interests in not having regulations that barred the route from their lab to market, except for me and the military contractors. And two other academics I worked with, one at Rice University here in Texas, which was great. So, I mean, there was the few people that didn't, we were assigned to write the chapter on environmental health, but all the other people were assigned to write all the other chapters. And in the draft, one of the other chapters actually said, don't let environmental health be the tail that steers the tiger, or whatever that is. And I almost went ballistic, and actually the DuPont person had to, like, get that. He was really good. He was in our chapter, and he was like, we're going to have to take that, or Jennifer's going to pop an artery. But, ask those questions when you talk to your audiences. Understand where they're coming from. For they might be incredible experts in nanomaterials and development, and they might have a very vested and appropriate interest in getting their materials to market. But they might not be the only audience you want to ask about some of the risks and some of the regulatory gaps and failures.
Does someone else have a question right here? Okay, the questions are there model regulations in other countries? Jennifer's shaking her head.
This would be a good report for you to look at it. This is the latest one from European Commission, communication from the Commission to the European Parliament, dated 3rd of October 2012, and they declare that they are working on these further evidences and things. So by 2014, I just want to be very clear on that, if you give me a minute, Melissa. So this would be, I think, going towards the regulatory regime here. A final assessment on review of all occupational health and safety legislation will be made. This is only the draft by 2014. So this would be one of the latest one we found that talks about where we are going on legislation and regulation.
Yeah.
This is the European Commission report to the Parliament, just off the press.
Well, REACH is going to be, would have more stringent nano rules or not?
The next REACH, maybe. It didn't get into the current REACH.
Yeah, they have linked REACH as well. So they have linked this to this. For journalists, I think this would be a good document.
Germany's been really good. I mean, Germany's great because it actually has a huge amount of chemical industry, but they're very good on this green stuff. So Germany's been pushing the European Union in a large way. The European Union has some proposals, but nothing even close to model regulation.
Can y'all say what REACH is, just in case everyone doesn't know?
The European Chemical framework for getting information about chemicals, right? It's not quite regulatory.
It's basically the documenting the origin of the chemical.
Yeah.
If you have to do any business with the European Commission, the chemical's origin and should be documented.
But it's not regulatory. And then EPA, Pesticide Office, has something that's stuck at OMB right now, the Office of Management and Budget, where they're actually just asking people, companies that are using pesticides that have nano in them to just report, and that's being blocked. So that, I mean, we're not at the level of legislation, we're at the level of disclosure right now. That's where the argument is right now.
So it sounds like the answer is no over here.
The answer is very no.
Okay, are any nanoparticles smaller than a water molecule? That's your question? Or the same size?
Yeah, if you had one that had like three atoms, that would be like an H2O. I think of them like way smaller than a bacteria and about the size of a virus. So if you think of where viruses go or immune particles go, that's how they travel in the body. That's correct. And actually, the water treatment folks have written a lot of letters to EPA that are all posted. There's a group called TriTac that is the California Water Treatment. And I've spoken at the water treatment conferences. They've invited me multiple times to speak to their annual conferences. They're very concerned, especially with nano silver, because they're afraid that all this silver clothing and stuff, the silver comes out, the nano silver comes out and is washed down the drain and gets into the water. And they're afraid that it will kill the beneficial bacteria that they require to treat their sludge, the sewer sludge. So they have multiple letters. They're quite outspoken on this issue.
Ram, did you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, another question? Yes?
Okay.
So the question is, where should we be going, according to
if
each?
I may?
Yes.
I'll address the research part. We need to go R&D on research on two things, because one, that's kind of an economic future, because any country can leapfrog us. China can leapfrog us in any minute. So we need to invest, but there should be an environmental aspect to that research. That's what we are lacking. We should put more money for investigating the toxicity in nano. If you look at the trend, we are doing awfully poor there. In the $18 billion so far from 2001 under nano initiative, only $650 million, they report from 2005, has been spent on this environmental health issues, and 350 million on legal and ethic issues. That means 1 billion totally. So R&D should be there, but it should have some environmental stewardship towards it. We need to do that.
So I agree with Ram that I don't think that research, I don't think you can regulate research, but in addition, I just don't think you should, and that's because I'm a scientist, so I just think, gosh, it's so cool. But there's about $1.8 billion in the federal budget, and there's about that much also in private, and we have no idea where the private is going. So when we talk about, you know, maybe 10 or 11 or 12% of the federal budget going towards environmental health and safety research, God knows how much is in the public and or in the private, probably none. So, I mean, you actually have twice $1.8 billion going towards moving these products into market, and I mean, 10 or less going into environmental health and safety research. And Aaron's group actually put out some nice calculations on that. So, in my opinion, which also is a legal opinion, I think that all new chemicals should be regulated and reviewed. And I think that nanochemicals should be regulated not as conventional, but as new chemicals. They should go through a new chemical review process. And then since I think that the new chemical, I mean, this is how I got into it. I didn't get into it from nano. I got into it because I do chemical policy. All new chemicals aren't regulated properly. And so my last thing I'm going to say is I think we should have TSCA reform. And TSCA reform is the Toxic Substances Control Act. So right now, there's about 7,000 new chemicals that get registered every year under TSCA, and EPA has 90 days to review those chemicals, each one of them. And if they don't make a determination within 90 days, the chemical automatically goes to market. That's the way the law is built right now for all industrial chemicals. 80,000 industrial chemicals in commerce, that's the way it's built. And in that 90 days, if EPA decides they do want more data, they have to make a justification for that based on health, which is hard because there's no data to make that justification. And if they, when the company puts in its application for a new chemical, it only has to supply the data it has on hand, which is usually nothing because it's a new chemical. So that's how chemicals are registered in this country. That is so bad that we need TSCA reform to support it. And right now, my organization has been working with environmental justice groups and nurses groups and, I mean, you know, 50 different groups representing all these different constituencies that will support chemical reform, TSCA reform. Senator Lautenberg has a bill on the floor. But right now, it's being opposed by the chemical industry, ACC, American Chemistry Council. They're the only ones opposing it, and they're opposing it by saying, well, we're for it, but we just don't think this is the right bill. And they've been doing that for about 5 years without coming up with one of their own. So they're just going to keep opposing TSCA reform, and that's what we really need, not just for nano, but for all new chemicals, which will mostly be nano.
Aaron?
Yeah, that's. It seems like the TSCA proposal would do a lot of what Jennifer's talking about. There's also sort of a fight over having a mandatory set aside for environmental health and safety research in the National Nano Technology Initiative reauthorization bill. Language that passed the House last year but didn't pass the Senate would have stressed the need for more EHS but didn't have a set aside. I think some of the groups like ETC Group in Canada and the International Center for Technology Assessment have argued that they want between 10 and 40%. Of that money set aside. I think Mikhail Rocco, who is one of the driving forces behind the NNI in his 2010 sort of decade report, said, you know, we haven't been doing as good a job as we should with EHS, if I remember correctly. And EHS funding has been creeping upward, but it's still at most about 5% of the total NNI authorization.
Okay, another question? Yes. So the advantages of using it in food packaging as well as the risks.
So nano in food packaging. So there's definitely nano silver being used in food packaging and food containers. And actually, Aaron has that on that website, and Ram also talked about that. I don't know about other stuff, to be honest. There's a lot of stuff that's being talked about, like smart food packaging that will tell you when your meat is going bad. But I'm not sure. Like, the food industry, I think, is a little nervous about getting into this. And we actually met. I met in a very small boardroom in the roof of a very beautiful building in New York City with McDonald's and their legal team. And they were talking with us about wanting to put nanomaterials in food packaging because they could make the food packaging lighter and easier, and therefore there'd be less waste if they use these nanoceramides. I think it was. And I said to them, well, do you have safety data on that? And they said, yeah, it's safe. I said, well, have you seen the safety data? And they said, well, our supply chain says it's safe. I said, well, have you seen the safety data? I think you should look at the safety data because you're very smart. And I think you should ask to see the data. And they hadn't. There was no data to back this claim up. So that was it. Then McDonald's, we've heard from them that they're not using it. So I think that maybe it's not as widespread. The R&D is there. Every Fortune 500 is invested. Every single Fortune 500 invested in nanomaterials, but I think maybe in the food industry it's not as widespread as the research.
Just a follow-up. The safety issue and data is not there, but I have seen some reports that say that there are some nanoparticles people are adding into edible ice creams to change the texture, to change the flavor and color.
Yeah,
but I have not seen any authenticated science data.
And
there's
the chocolate bubble gum.
Yeah, chocolate things gum. Like that. So even known brands are doing it, but...
And there's some on your website. There's also a chocolate diet or a nutritional supplement.
Yeah, well, that might be like an energy mix.
Yeah, because chocolate doesn't go into solution very well, it turns out, but nano chocolate does.
Well, but what would be the benefits if it was used in food packaging? Why would they be using it? To make it lighter?
It's fresher, longer.
Fresher.
The nano silver is used because it kills bacteria, so the food stays fresher longer, and that's how it's being advertised. So they're getting out of the pesticidal claim. At first they said it kills bacteria, and that was a pesticidal claim, and EPA said we're going to regulate you. And so then they said, well, it actually keeps food fresher longer. So that's what they have right now, which gets them out of the regulation. So that's how they're evading regulation.
And the term they normally use to get away from all is shelf life. It enhances the shelf life of the food product.
And it does.
And one of the first nano products was this Sharper Image Tupperware that you could buy, right, yep. Where you put your food in it. And that's the one where didn't the packaging change?
Yeah, there's this super cool website called Wayback Machine. Do you guys know about this? Yeah, Wayback Machine rocks. So it's like you go to this website and you can see people's websites that they've changed. So like when I was working on the nanosilver food packaging issue in Sharper Image, I'm on EPA's Federal Advisory Committee, so I have all sorts of opportunities to put this in front of EPA. And so then they changed their website and they changed the language. But with Wayback Machine, if you put in the link into Wayback Machine, it'll get to that old one that's been saved in these trawlers. So yeah.
And we probably have time for one more question.
I haven't been keeping an eye on it. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, you can repeat the question.
Oh, how many is anyone tracking EPA's SNRs? Like regulatory actions under TSCA, or not regulatory actions, but actions under TSCA. And I think there's only been a handful of them, right?
Over 100. So you can go to EPA's website actually, and they're pretty good on this issue. And on the under TSCA New Chemicals Program. I can give you this. Jim Allwood made a presentation in 2010. That's how I have it. But I have the updated website I use. And there's more than 100 new chemical notices for nanomaterials that have been received since 2005. Numerous pre-manufactured notices have been completed within the 90-day review. But again, they're not asking for much data, and these things are going to market. And the carbon nanotubes, as I said, have been done. And we're working with steelworkers and AFL-CIO and a bunch of other unions together with me, our ICTA also, trying to get that stopped. So the question is, like, once you get it approved, what are the limits? The answer is the sky. So the way TSCA works is you never look back again. Pesticides, thanks to a lawsuit by NRDC and some negotiations, pesticides have to be re-reviewed and re-registered every 15 years, but not industrial chemicals. So when you fill out a form for a PNN, and you can get all this. You can ask EPA, or I can give you my FOIA document and file. You have to fill out what you're using it for, where you're manufacturing it, what your health and safety stuff is, all this stuff, but it's all redacted when I get it, and they never have to go back and look at it. So if they say we're making it in one location and we're going to make 3 grams a year, then 10 years later, that's forever.
Did anybody else want to respond to that? Well, I think we have about 5 minutes before we're supposed to be downstairs for lunch, so if you guys want to corral these speakers and maybe ask another couple of questions, but we were asked to be downstairs right at noon, and I want to be back.
Yeah, thanks to our panelists.
I don't know, listen to your website.